What do you get when you cross a mentally ill loner with a society that abandons him and treats him like trash? In 1980s Gotham, we get Joker. In 1970s New York City, we get Travis Bickle. But in 1990s Los Angeles, we get Bill Foster, an unassuming, hardworking family man who happens to be just one bad day away from a murderous rampage. And decades later, and it feels like falling down, is almost an omen for modern life in the West. As the movie shows us exactly just how close to madness most of the population is due to the economic, social, and existential pressures of modern life. The movie is a warning on all of the steps that lead to a society creating the circumstances for your own downfall. It's a powerful warning that many may have missed in 1993. So in this video, we're going to be going over the hidden meaning and the real truth about falling down. Bill's one day starts in a fashion similar to many of us. He's in his car on his way to his 9-to-5. He's wearing a bland shirt and tie to adhere to a dress code with a briefcase in hand. Bill is a quintessential rule follower, but today, Bill is stuck in gridlock traffic due to road construction in the middle of an LA heatwave, and several minor frustrations begin to stack in to what seems to be the universe's efforts to break him. We see that his AC and windows are broken. There's a fly in his car, bumper stickers preach at him, all antagonizing him. Rival commuters aimlessly contributing to noise pollution with their loud phone conversations and honking. From Bill's perspective, this freeway might as well be a jungle from hell. The commuters are animals, and there's nothing Bill can do to remove himself from it or fix his problems. He's trapped, and despite doing everything he's told he should do by society on a daily basis, Bill is helpless to change his fate and rise above his personal hell. And we can assume, after not just one morning, but years of the same monotonous grating commute, today was the perfect storm for Bill to reach his breaking point. He decides that following the rules and norms of society is no longer serving him. And so he decides to break free, opening his door and leaving his car in the middle of the road. And it's in this moment that Bill makes it clear that he's no longer going to work. For once in his life, Bill is pushing against the system rather than complicitly acting as a cog within it. But unfortunately for Bill, this will have severe consequences, and his journey home will not go without resistance. But we'll get onto that soon. Bill's first stop is to an unassuming convenience store, and at the beginning, things start innocently enough. Bill asks a simple favor of the shopkeeper. He needs change to use for a payphone across the street. The shopkeeper refuses the favor, closes the till, and tells Bill he must first buy something to get the change he needs. Another small minor inconvenience for Bill, and one that we might experience daily, but it also says something about the setting this film is taking place in. This roadblock for Bill perfectly illustrates the knock-on effects of the giant unending suburban sprawl resulting from the dystopian capitalist hellhole of LA. LA is seen by many to be a dystopian capitalist society, with one of the biggest gaps between the wealthy and the working class, where just being able to survive the next month is becoming harder and harder for most people living there, all with a slither of people in the city living in absolute luxury. But as people struggle more and more, they tend to become more desperate. They take advantage of each other, commit crimes, and become way more protective of what little they have left. And because of this, the trust between human beings completely deteriorates, and a high trust society becomes a low trust one. And when people no longer trust each other and are increasingly desperate,
Los Angeles is dealing with a spike in brazen and sometimes deadly robberies. From high-end stores in Hollywood to mansions there, thieves have been stealing hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of jewelry, electronics, and much more. LA police say robberies are up about 17% this year compared to the same time last year.
Commodification becomes more ruthless. Things that were free before now cost more money, all gradually rising over time. And this slowly eliminates the existence of the favor. Now we reserve a favor behind a paywall because we no longer value or have trust in the social capital and sense of community it once gave us. With the frustrations that come along with existing in such a society brewing in the back of his mind, Bill obliges with the shopkeeper. He returns to the counter with a can of soda only to find the shopkeeper has overpriced it and that purchasing the can won't leave him with enough change to pay for the phone call. This is where Bill starts to get political. He starts pointing out the shopkeeper's race and drawing lines in the sand between my country and your country. And although on the surface this seems like Bill is just a racist, what this scene is really trying to illustrate is how Bill is becoming isolated and alienated from his immediate community. He's frustrated with the shopkeeper who, despite being an immigrant, is in the same strata of society as he is, both working under the same conditions in the same city. But deep down, he's really frustrated with those of higher status and power who dictate this economy and society, the ones who are directly influencing the rate of inflation and in turn the cost of the soda, which becomes apparent in Bill's subsequent rant. After Bill's rant, the shopkeeper tells Bill to leave, and so Bill stands his ground, and we get the sense that this is something that the old Bill would never have done. The altercation even gets physical, but Bill wins out, and for once in his life, he's finally in control. He uses his position on the unfamiliar side of a power dynamic to make a point about inflation while destroying the shop. Bill justifies his rampage by calling the shopkeeper a thief, criminalizing the victim and positioning himself as a vigilante standing up for the rights of the consumer. And when he leaves, he doesn't steal. Instead, he pays the price he deems to be fair for the soda and takes his change. And it's clear at this moment that Bill has no intention of being an actual criminal. In his own eyes, he's still a law-abiding citizen who will not cross that line. And a small piece of him still believes that society will one day reward him for that, despite a lifetime of evidence to the contrary. And it's at this point we get a proper introduction to the film's other main character, Detective Martin Prendergast. We learn that the detective is with the LAPD, and today is his last day. And from the time we spend with the detective in subsequent scenes, we can see that he and Bill in many ways are two sides of the exact same coin. Like Bill, the detective is a rule follower. He bends his will to those around him in the hope that one day he will be rewarded. But instead he's met with disregard and disrespect by his peers, his superiors, and society as a whole. The detective's subservient role at work is mirrored by a subservient role at home. We learn that it's Prendergast's last day because his wife is forcing him to retire early and move to Arizona against his own desires. Furthermore, we learn that Prendergast took himself off the streets and took a desk role due to his wife's fears rather than his own. And when we finally meet the detective, he's really a shell of a man, simply going through the motions, being bossed around by his bitchy wife and a corrupted society. And much like Bill, the detective starts to take more control over his situation as the film progresses, but what separates the detective and Bill is how they choose to exert control and the motivations for doing so. In that sense, these two characters couldn't be more different, and in the end, it's why and how they take control that leads to one of them living their life happily ever after, and the other dying in tragedy. But for now, Bill is still on his way home, and he has a long way to go. After he gets done using the payphone, Bill finds a spot to take a rest, and we learn that his shoes have a hole in them from walking. This is yet another sign that Bill is struggling financially. First the old broken car he was driving, then the lack of cash to pay for a can of soda, and now a hole in his shoe. But why would Bill, a man employed with a white-collar job, be unable to afford a new pair of shoes? I mean, it's really hard not to feel angry at the state of the economy, especially when regular, everyday things start to become unaffordable, especially with tech products. It seems like tech is becoming more and more overly inflated in price, which is why I want to tell you about Raycon's everyday earbuds and how they just got even better, as their upgraded model now features active noise cancellation. Now, you may have heard me talk about Raycon's everyday earbuds before and thought, wait, the same audio quality I expect from the big guys but at half the price? That sounds pretty good. Which has allowed Raycon to sell 3 million of their previous everyday earbuds, and so you know they're popular. But if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have but you're not in the market for another pair because they're just that good, now is the time to check them out, because they just launched the upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. When I used them, I couldn't believe how good they were, especially for the price. Some of my favorite features are the new quick charge function, so I never have to wait around long for them to be fully charged, and their sweat resistance feature, which means I can just work out in them and I never have to worry about them being damaged. You see, when I'm in the gym doing an intense workout, I use the active noise cancellation to blur the background sound out, allowing me to listen to podcasts with zero distractions. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there's truly no better time. Their upgraded model will blow you away, and you're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner. And Raycon even offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So what are you waiting for? Click the link in the description box or go to buyraycon.com/moonyt to get 20% off of your Raycon purchase plus free shipping. This question will be fully answered for us later, but unfortunately Bill's moment of respite is interrupted by two gang members who claim the spot Bill is sitting on is their territory. Bill actually reasons with them and agrees to leave if they let him, likening the situation to a neighbourly dispute where one neighbour has accidentally crossed into the other's yard. Again, this is Bill longing for a time where people had a defined sense of community. But the two gang members don't let Bill leave, and so they demand a payment from Bill to serve as a toll for passing through.
I think it should be a toll.
Good idea.
Should be a toll.
Oddly enough, they demand his briefcase, and perhaps even more strange, Bill refuses to give it to them. risking his life to keep it. Now, what could be inside his briefcase that's so valuable to Bill? Well, the briefcase value to Bill isn't actually about what's inside of it. The briefcase's value is in what it represents to Bill. Traditionally, a briefcase holds the contents of a man's work. The briefcase is a representation of Bill's place as a working man and a positive contributor to society. If he doesn't have that, he's no different from the people he sees as the problem. Those who break the rules and contribute to the social decay daily. This is who he blames for making his life a monotonous hell with no reward to show for it. In Bill's mind, the briefcase is what tells the world that he's one of the good guys. But surely after Bill fights off these two gang members, we get a pairing of scenes that suggest Bill hasn't just reached his breaking point overnight. He's actually had this darkness inside of him for quite some time now. In the first of these two scenes, Bill finds his way to another payphone and we find out where he's going. From a short conversation with his ex-wife, Beth, we find out that Bill actually isn't allowed in the house he's been calling home or even to see his own daughter.
I gotta see you.
No, you listen to me. This is my house now. I pay the rent. I mean, you don't even pay child support. You just can't walk in and out whenever you feel.
But this new Bill is determined to disregard the court-ordered restrictions and pay his former family a visit. And again, he creates justification for himself by pointing out today is his daughter's birthday. In Bill's mind, this visit should simply be a father paying his daughter a visit on her birthday rather than a man breaking his fearful ex-wife's restraining order. And later in the second of these two scenes, we get some context. Beth calls the police after the threat from Bill. From the conversation with the officer, we learn that Bill has never before crossed the line.
Did he strike the little girl?
Well, no.
Did he strike you?
Not exactly.
He's never hit her or his daughter. He's never partaken in drugs or alcohol excessively. He's not even broken into the home before. Next, we find out that the restraining order on Bill was in response to his temper. It's not in place because of anything he's actually done, but instead a perception that he has the capacity to harm.
Does he drink?
No, I wouldn't say so.
Do drugs?
Oh, no.
Beth explains that she thought the restraining order would put Bill in an even darker place, making things worse for him. But the judge wanted to make an example of him by disregarding Beth's concerns. So the officer decides they can't offer security to Beth on threats alone. Since Bill has no history of crossing the line, the police leave Beth and her daughter on their own. Whilst these scenes give us a glimpse into Bill's character and motivations, they also say something about the failures of the system and its lack of support on both sides. In this case, the court has somewhat arbitrarily taken away a man's access to his own daughter with seemingly no mental health support. Or avenue back. This decision has started Bill on his own path to becoming the man we're starting to see in the film, a man with nothing to lose, a dangerous man. But at the same time, the court is offering no support or physical protection for the family, who now feel that they're in danger because of the soon-to-be monster they had a key hand in creating. The system is failing Bill's family as much as it seems to be failing him. After Bill hangs up the phone, the gang members drive by and shoot at him with machine guns. Fortunately for Bill, their revenge is thwarted by their terrible aim. They completely miss him with their bullets and instead shoot multiple bystanders. Amidst the chaos, the gang members crash their car, and the crash fatally injures all of them. So Bill calmly takes a moment to taunt the lone gang member who's still living. He stands over him and aims the gun at the gang member's head. It seems like at this moment, Bill might finally be ready to cross the line. However, Bill opts to shoot the man in the leg instead and leaves the scene, but not before packing up a bag with all of the gang's weapons. Bill's hesitancy to kill at this moment, even when he's faced with a fatally wounded man who tried to assassinate him just moments before, signals to us that Bill is still internally maintaining his status as a complicit member of society, despite his continuous acts of disobedience when faced with the status quo so far. He doesn't see himself as a criminal and refuses to be put in the same category. But despite Bill's continuous spiral, there's still a small sliver of hope within him that his luck will turn around. Because Bill still believes that luck and circumstance can't completely derail the American dream for an individual. The American dream, of course, is the fleeting ideal that anyone, regardless of class or situation, can achieve upward mobility, financial success, and a life of happiness if they work hard enough and operate with the tools American society affords them. However, as many of us already know, this isn't really true. The system in America isn't exactly a meritocracy. In 2024, more and more, it's designed to keep people in their place, and oftentimes it's down to pure luck or a slither of chance whether someone climbs up or, in Bill's case, falls down. Though it's evidence in the scene that even this new version of Bill, who's had a psychotic break, still holds on to this ideal and believes he'll start reaping the rewards he was promised in the terms put forth by the so-called American Dream. Immediately after the shootout, Bill is met with yet another detour, having to alter his route due to the construction on the sidewalk. A frustrating reminder of how this day begun for Bill. The worker really tells Bill to find another way around. And despite Bill having just shot a man, he obliges.
Where you going?
Going home.
Not this way or not.
Why not?
Metro Rail Construction, that's why not.
Bill decides to take a walk through the park where he's immediately heckled and solicited by a homeless man. The homeless man makes up a sob story, lies multiple times about his identity, and begs Bill for a handout.
I'm almost out of gas. I had to sleep in my car last night. I don't suppose you have a couple of bucks you could give me? It would really help me out.
Bill asks to see proof of his stories, and repeatedly denies the request for money. But the man doesn't leave Bill alone. The man instead demands one of the two bags in Bill's hands, one containing Bill's work life and the other containing the weapons Bill collected from the dead gang members. Bill oddly enough decides to do as he's asked and hands the homeless man his briefcase. But when the homeless man opens the briefcase, he's upset to find that the only items inside of it are chips, a flattened sandwich, and an apple. Now, there are two main things to analyze in the scene. The first is how Bill handles the interaction with the homeless man. It would be okay to think Bill's being a bit heartless during the scene, but Bill not wanting to give this man money makes perfect sense given Bill's character. The Bill we've gotten to know over the course of this film has done everything he's been told to do. He's a consumer, an NPC, an American conformist. He's taken on the burden of working a 9-to-5. He's obeyed the law his whole life. He's started a family. He's mortgaged a home. And yet, even with all these staples of the American dream, he has barely anything to show for it. Bill has been playing the American game. But by breaking free, he's now finally found confidence in who he really is, in his masculinity. So why would Bill give what little hard-earned money he possesses to a man who he's cross-examined and found out has never even tried to play the game in the first place? In Bill's eyes, why should he be responsible for someone who failed to subscribe to the American dream? Bill remains in denial that both luck and born circumstance are always factors, and maybe the biggest factors in determining one's success in the world. The second key element of the scene to analyze is the reveal of there being nothing of substance inside Bill's briefcase. It's both surprising and unsurprising depending on how you look at it. This whole time we've been assuming that Bill was on his way to work at the beginning of the movie. After all, he's dressed for the part, but now it's clear that Bill might have been fired from his job weeks ago and he's been leaving the house in the mornings maintaining his normal routine and simply keeping up the appearance of actually having a job. In turn, he's maintaining the image of being a viable and valued member of society, not only to others but to himself. He fears being seen as an unemployed non-contributor. He fears having worked and lived by the letter of the law his whole life with nothing to show for it. But in this moment, he leaves behind his briefcase, signaling he's one step closer to leaving this facade behind. Now that he's given away his lunch, Bill makes a pit stop at Whammy Burger, a fictional fast food restaurant, and what happens next would infuriate even the best of us. It's a tale as old as fast food itself. Bill asks for breakfast. The staff tells him they stop serving breakfast at 11:30. Unfortunately for Bill, it's 11:33.
Yes, I'd like a ham and cheese omelette. Wham fries.
I'm sorry. We stopped serving breakfast, but we are on the lunch menu now.
I want breakfast.
Well, you can't have it. We're not serving it.
Bill refuses to take no for an answer, and when the staff refuses to budge, Bill takes out the machine gun from his gym bag. Everybody panics, and Bill starts to realize what he's doing, so he tries to calm people down. He insists that nobody leaves and everybody sits down and continue to eat their lunches like nothing else is happening. As he begins to understand he's the reason everyone has fear in their eyes, he changes his mind and decides he's okay with ordering from the lunch menu. He then tries to make small talk with a few patrons, making jokes, desperately trying to keep the mood in the restaurant light and maintain a sense of normalcy.
You, ma'am, how's the food? I don't think she likes the special sauce, Rick. That's a joke.
One of Bill's worst fears is being realized at this moment as the restaurant full of regular working class people stare directly at him with fear in their eyes. It's like he's looking in a mirror for the first time in the movie. They see him as the outcast that he is. He wants them to stop seeing him that way and instead choose to see him how he sees himself. A normal, decent, hardworking, productive member of society. A working American man. After several seconds of mass uncomfortability, Bill is handed his lunch by the staff, and in one last ditch effort to get the people back on his side, Bill delivers a short but emboldened speech directed at the staff. He calls them out for false advertising, comparing his sad, flattened burger to the plump, juicy one depicted in the photo on the menu. And this yet is another self-report by Bill. Bill, a man who feels like he's been lied to over and over again by those who sold him an upper-middle-class dream, an American dream, is once again pointing out another form of lie that we all experience and accept every single day. In this moment, Bill looks for validation from the crowd in the restaurant, some sign that he's not the only one who's disgruntled by being met with not only a small daily infraction of false advertising, but all of the daily anti-social, anti-consumer, and anti-human behavior that we've grown to accept as normal.
Can anybody tell me what's wrong with this picture? Anybody at all?
But instead of whatever response he was hoping for, Bill is met with only wide-eyed looks and fear from other adults in the room. His point has fallen on deaf ears. News of Bill's trip to Whammy Burger has quickly travelled to Brenda Cast, who's been uniquely positioned to hear stories of Bill's journey all day. And where other officers in the police department are convinced these reported crimes are unrelated, Brenda Cast is connecting the dots. And as the pieces start coming together, we start to see a different side of him that was presumably dormant within him at the start of the movie. He's reinvigorated by having a case inadvertently thrust upon him. Prendergast seemingly can't wait to be on the streets and amongst the community again, and he's slowly realizing that retiring and retreating to isolation in Arizona out of fear or comfort is no way for him to truly live. It goes against his masculine destiny. And although Prendergast and Bill are sharing a lot of similar feelings in regards to their own expendability, especially within the rogue community and society as a whole, they choose to take control in very different ways. Prendergast finds control in doing his small part to help reshape the community around him, to embody the responsibility and care he wishes everyone to take. This is because Prendergast doesn't believe his fellow man is beyond repair. Bill, on the other hand, does believe this. So instead of finding control by helping where he can like Prendergast, Bill is finding control by rebelling against anyone he feels as contributing negatively to his community and in the process, taking what he feels he deserves as someone who has always contributed positively. And although there are personal circumstances that explain why they react to their feelings the way they do, which the film does explore more closely, it's becoming more clear at this point in the movie that Prendergast represents a proactive approach to finding a sense of fulfillment and belonging, while Bill represents a reactive approach, offense and defense, which in many cases is understandable, but terrifying for American society as a whole. Defense in Bill's case, we come to learn, is an integral part of his character. It's core to who he is. We see this in each and every one of his actions so far, because Bill's crimes have merely been violent responses to others who are in one form or another trying to take advantage of him or hinder his journey's progress. And if that wasn't enough for understand that Bill's internal philosophy is primarily defensive despite his violence, the word defense is literally written on Bill's license plate. But soon enough, Bill's defensive nature would be tested to the utmost degree. Before that, however, Bill makes a pit stop at a swap meet to buy a gift for his daughter's birthday, a snow globe. However, this swap meet is across the street from a bank, and Bill can't help but notice a man who's protesting outside of it. The man is shouting a story about how he was denied a loan and pointing out those who were accepted. He makes a point about how the bank and in turn the powers that be told him he was not economically viable.
7 years I banked in. It told me that I was not economically viable.
The man is arrested by police officers despite committing no visible crime, and as he's been taken away, he meets eyes with Bill, and in their final and only exchange, he tells Bill not to forget him. If it wasn't made obvious by the protester and Bill wearing identical clothing, this is yet another moment that forces Bill to hold a mirror to himself. Bill identifies with this man because he's been feeling the same feelings. After his divorce and losing his job, Bill is struggling financially, and he's quickly discovered that when you're struggling financially, you're no longer seen as economically viable by society, and in turn, completely worthless to everyone. People treat you differently, you become an outcast, and sometimes, like in this protester's case, you're viewed as a criminal. In a dystopian, hyper-capitalist economy, when you no longer have value to businesses or corporations, you no longer have value to the government or even your fellow man. You're subhuman. You get looked down upon as lesser, until you either gain enough money to matter or die trying. And although Bill feels treated like a criminal ever since he lost his job, he's now literally a criminal due to his recent actions. So after a short verbal altercation with a stranger where he destroys a glass phone booth with a machine gun, Bill finds himself in a position where the consequences of his crimes might finally catch up with him when he enters a military surplus store. While shopping for some boots to replace his worn-out shoes, the shopkeeper takes a strange interest in Bill, and then starts hurling slurs at a gay couple patronizing the store. The situation escalates, and the shopkeeper draws a gun on them, ultimately forcing them to leave. While Bill continues shopping, a detective arrives. She describes Bill and asks the shopkeeper if she's seen him.
Police officer, I'm looking for a man.
Are you now?
White shirt and tie. He'd be carrying a gym bag.
The tension builds, but to Bill's surprise, the shopkeeper covers for him.
So have you seen anyone like I've described?
Nope.
Okay, thanks.
And once the detective leaves, the shopkeeper brings Bill to the basement and shows him a secret stash of high-powered weapons and old Nazi memorabilia. He goes as far as to give Bill a bazooka, powerful enough to take out a jumbo jet. And when Bill asks why, the shopkeeper reveals that he's been listening to the police scanner all day and recognized him.
It's for you.
Why?
Because I'm with you. Don't you get it? I was listening to the police scanner. I heard about the whammy burger. Fucking fantastic.
He's inspired by Bill's violent acts, believing Bill to be a racist vigilante of sorts who's been committing hate crimes. He tells Bill that he's with him and they're on the same team. Bill insists they're not the same. In Bill's mind, he's simply a man standing his ground, trying to preserve any shred of decency left in American society, and not an extremist outcast fueled by hate.
We're the same, don't you see?
We are not the same.
Bill, despite his rage, still sees himself as part of the community that includes people the shopkeeper disdains. So Bill once again refuses the comparison to take it a step further by referring to himself as an American and referring to the shopkeeper as a sick asshole.
I'm an American. You're a sick asshole.
When the shopkeeper gets upset by this, Bill says he disagrees with his ideals and launches into a short rant about how in America, they have the freedom to disagree.
Are you fucking with me?
I am
you're
just
disagreeing with you.
In America, we have the freedom of speech. The right to disagree!
But Bill knows deep down that this isn't actually the truth. It's just an ideal written on a piece of paper that nobody has actually even read. And this is exemplified by what happens next. The shopkeeper pulls a gun on Bill as he walks away, forcing him to surrender himself. The shopkeeper searches Bill's bag and smashes the snow globe Bill brought for his daughter. The shopkeeper then threatens to handcuff Bill and have sex with him. In the process, Bill then falls down, grabs a knife, and stabs the shopkeeper out of self-defense. Bill now has the chance to escape, but he doesn't. Instead, while the shopkeeper is in shock from the stab wound, Bill shoots him in the back repeatedly, and for the first time in the movie, Bill has not only acted defensively, but he's actually killed someone. This is Bill's point of no return, the point in the story where it's no longer possible to go back to the way things were in the beginning. He even says this out loud in another, this time very threatening, phone call to Beth.
Past the point of no return, Beth.
From this point forward, Bill is a changed man, more dangerous than ever now that he's become a murderer, and in turn, the type of person he's always viewed as truly unredeemable and uncivilized. In Bill's head, he's now officially an outsider, and he's at war with society rather than its defender. The film makes this transformation very clear, as we never see Bill in his white-collar corporate attire again. Instead, this new Bill sports a full military uniform he stole from the surplus store. Meanwhile, Prendergast vocalizes his observations, linking all these crimes together to his department's chief. But is pleased to ramp up a larger investigation full on deaf ears, so he decides to take matters into his own hands, and for the first time in the movie, Prendergast leaves his desk and hits the streets, abandoning his post to return to the field as a detective on his own accord. So as Bill experiences a big change, we see a parallel but contrasting change in Prendergast. For the first time, we see a Prendergast who is excited by his work again. He's finally passionate, retaking control of his life, breaking the shackles placed on him by his boss and his wife. This pays off for Prendergast and the LAPD, because the search for Bill's identity starts strong. He almost immediately tracks down Bill's abandoned car from the start of the movie and takes note of the license plate. Prendergast now has his first lead on Bill, but Bill is still very much at large, and the next time we see him, it's in a very similar situation. His journey takes him to a long line of traffic being held up by road construction, the exact situation that caused him to snap at the start of the movie. However, this is a different Bill than the one we saw then, and if we didn't already realize this, Bill reminds us by punching and knocking out an obnoxious driver who's non-stop yelling at the cars in front of him. New Bill has no tolerance for such behavior. He marches to the front and immediately confronts one of the construction workers who's causing the delay. Bill interrogates the man, demanding to know what's wrong with the street. When the man refuses to tell him, Bill cites the street was fine just 2 days ago and goes on to say that he knows the whole thing is a lie.
2 days ago was fine. You telling me the street fell apart 2 days?
Well, I guess so.
Pardon me, but that's bullshit.
Bill says that the problem with the street doesn't exist, and instead the city is trying to justify its inflated budgets with made-up jobs. If they don't spend the money they have projected this year, they won't give the same amount next year.
See, I don't think anything's wrong with the street. I think you're just trying to justify your inflated budgets.
What are you, nuts?
No, I know how it works. Now I want you to admit there's nothing wrong with the street. Fuck you, pal, huh?
After flashing his gun, Bill then gives the construction worker another chance to explain the problem with the street. The worker gets caught in another lie and eventually admits there's nothing wrong with the street, validating Bill's theory.
You're lying. What's wrong with the street?
Nothing.
So then Bill takes out his bazooka and threatens to give them something to fix. Bill struggles for a moment, not knowing how to use the bazooka, and suddenly a group of children arrive on bicycles. One child believes Bill might be an actor filming a movie. He proceeds to teach Bill how to fire the bazooka, claiming he's seen someone do it on TV. Bill accidentally shoots the bazooka in the wrong direction, but succeeds in causing an explosion that destroys construction equipment. This causes people to run in terror and signifies a full circle moment for Bill from the start of the movie. Where Bill failed to take control before, he has finally found the power to do so. However, Bill takes control in a completely destructive way that will only alienate him further from his community. So despite his intention to be the hero that takes down bureaucratic corruption, which is a known widespread frustration to everyone in Los Angeles, his execution will ultimately make him a villain and an outcast. However, this new Bill has already accepted his fate, and is exactly what emboldens him to act on his frustrations where others usually show restraint or compliance. While Bill is terrorizing construction workers, Prendergast has discovered where Bill lives. He visits the house to find that Bill is living with his mother after the divorce. Prendergast then searches Bill's tidied room and finds out that he was employed at a military defense plant.
What's he been doing lately?
Same as ever. He's building important things to protect us from the communists.
Prendergast questions Bill's mother, and she reveals that Bill blames her for his divorce and that she's afraid of Bill because he exhibits disturbing behavior at home.
He doesn't want me to know where she is. He blames me for what happened.
Prendergast realizes that when Bill said he was going home after leaving his car behind this morning, he meant he was going to visit his ex-wife and daughter. Before the scene ends, Prendergast's partner reveals that Bill was fired from the defense plant over a month prior, and Bill's mother is shocked because she has no idea.
Where has he been going every day? Where has he been eating his lunch?
He's been leaving the house with a packed lunch to go to work every day, which just adds another layer to Bill. It explains why he feels so let down by his country and government. Bill's pursuit of the American dream has been derailed by being deemed surplus to requirements by his employer. This is devastating enough on its own for most people to lose faith in the system. But Bill's employer is the US government. Bill has literally dedicated years of his life in servitude to his country, and in return, his country tossed him aside with nothing to show for it. And during the next stop on his journey, Bill, for the first time in the movie, will interact with the people who have everything to show for their efforts. The people who are living out his American dream and hoarding the benefits for themselves. The ultra wealthy. Because Bill's path home takes him through a golf course, a playground for economically elite men, and the stereotypical poster for exclusivity and gross resource hoarding. While Bill passes through, he walks into the playing area of two older golfers. Frustrated with him for making them pause with his presence, one of the golfers throws a tantrum, declaring he pays dues to his club to keep men like Bill out, and repeatedly refers to the course as mine. The man, in the midst of his entitled rage, decides to launch a golf ball right at Bill. So Bill ducks and immediately pulls out a shotgun. Suddenly, Bill has the power and takes the opportunity to lecture the golfers on his perspective. He calls them out for launching a golf ball in his direction, where they're surrounded by hundreds of beautiful acres fenced off from the rest of the city to play their little game. He goes further to say that they should have children playing there, families enjoying picnics, implying the golf course should be converted to land for the public to enjoy, rather than a percentage of rich men with nothing better to do.
You should have children playing here. You should have families having picnics. You should have a goddamn petting zoo.
Bill shoots their golf cart, and when he does, the man who hit the golf ball drops to the ground, suffering a heart attack. The man calls for his pills that were in the golf cart. Bill implies that pills won't do anything for his heart, as it's already rotten to the core. Bill and the old man watch as the golf cart rolls into the water hazard. Bill taunts the golfer's heart as his life-saving pills drown. Bill then tells the man he should have just let him pass through his golf course, but now he's gonna die wearing his stupid little hat. Bill leaves the man to die and then continues home. He jumps the fence from the golf course into the backyard of a lavish mansion. He sees the family who lives there having a barbecue by the pool, and he chews them out because his hand was cut on the barbed wire fence that encloses the yard. Bill points out that it's a very hostile way to treat innocent outsiders. The man in the family reveals that he's just the housekeeper, and that the owner of the house is a doctor who's let them use the house before. Bill then further learns that due to his military outfit, the housekeeper fears Bill is a security guard with a private security company that the owner hires to protect the property. When Bill denies his association, police sirens can be heard surrounding in the house, and so Bill takes the family hostage. When Bill asks what kind of doctor lives in such a large house, the housekeeper reveals the owner is a plastic surgeon. And of course, Bill's disappointed in the idea that plastic surgery can buy this. So he starts to explain to the family that he lost his job because he's overeducated and underskilled, with himself being viewed as obsolete. He's not economically viable anymore, and he can't even afford to support his own family.
I'm overeducated, underskilled, and I'm obsolete. I'm not economically viable.
And yet a plastic surgeon, making people look more and more fake, is able to live in such a huge mansion. When Bill remembers his daughter, he seems to snap back to reality and realize what he's doing for a moment. We see a glimpse of the old Bill, who he was before the point of no return. So he lets go of the little girl's arm and apologizes for scaring her, nervous that he might have hurt her. The housekeeper then offers himself to Bill as a hostage if he lets the family go.
Please take me with you.
No!
They won't do anything as long as I'm with you.
And Bill is offended by the suggestion, but mainly because they see him as a danger, an outsider, and again, not as one of them. He tries to change this by explaining he has a family of his own. He tells the family that he's on his way home for his daughter's birthday and plans to have a barbecue just like they were, where his daughter would play outside and his wife would hold his hand.
It's my little girl's birthday today. We were going to have a barbecue like you guys. She was going to play outside and my wife hold my hand.
He says this not only to convince the family, but to convince himself that he's the type of person deserving of the suburban fantasy and not a criminal. We know this isn't true, and Bill does too deep down. After all, he's past the point of no return. But what Bill says next is disturbing. Bill continues painting the picture of the perfect day he and his family are going to spend together once he makes it home, and how once night falls, they'll all go to sleep together in the dark and everything will be like it was before.
And then when it got dark, we'd all go to sleep together. Everything would be just like it was before.
From his tone, and considering his recent threatening call to his ex-wife, it's clear that Bill could be suggesting a more permanent vision of sleep at the end of the story. With that, the pressure for Prendergast to find Bill and protect his family is rising. However, the LAPD continues to be dismissive of Beth's concerns, citing the lack of funding and public support as a reason for not being able to provide security detail on her home. They still have no idea that her ex-husband is the same man who's been committing various crimes throughout the city of LA, all day. Neither do they have any clue that these crimes are all related. But luckily, Prendergast is making progress on his own. He discovers Bill's murders at both a military surplus store and the golf course, and realizes Bill's path leads to Venice. At the same time, Prendergast's partner finds Beth's address in Venice, and they finally know where Bill is headed. So Prendergast alerts the closest police department to send units to Beth's house immediately, but they refuse, insisting they've already visited Beth's house multiple times in the same day.
They say they can't justify sending units to the same address three times in one day to comfort some hysterical.
Prendergast decides that he and his partner must go to protect Beth themselves, and hopefully intercept Bill before he gets there. On Prendergast's way out, his wife interrupts him with a phone call during which she hysterically beckons him home, and seconds later, his department interrupts him with a surprise retirement party. Prendergast uses the sense of urgency that the situation calls for and takes both opportunities to finally stand his ground. He hangs up on his wife and punches the detective from his department, who's been doing nothing but disrespecting him all day. And just like that, Prendergast's race against the clock to find Bill before he reaches his family is on. But it may already be too late. Bill calls Beth and suggests he's at a location right around the corner. Beth hangs up, grabs her daughter, and starts to run. At the same time, Bill runs towards the house. He gets the front door right as Beth and her daughter exit through the back. Not knowing where they've run off to, Bill enters the house and takes a moment to watch some old home movies in an attempt to live in the warming memory of his once perfect, now departed family life. But while the tape starts off all warm and fuzzy, showing Bill the perfect home life he remembers, they later begin to show Bill that it wasn't perfect at all. There's snippets of arguments between Bill and Beth that highlights his temper and her growing contempt for him.
Put her on the horse! I bought her the goddamn horse. There we go!
But as the home movies hold yet another mirror to Bill, they also remind him of Beth's favorite place, the pier. Bill now realizes where his family must have run off to, and just as he makes this realization, Prendergast arrives outside of the house. So Bill shoots Prendergast's partner, incapacitating her, and escapes. Prendergast makes sure the neighbors call an ambulance for his partner and runs after Bill in pursuit. But Bill makes it to the pier, and there he finds, just as he suspected, his ex-wife Beth and their daughter. He immediately confronts Beth in a moment of psychosis. He tries to kiss her and calls her his wife. She expresses fear and corrects him to remind him that she's not his wife anymore. Bill realizes from Beth's reactions that no amount of forcing it will make his dream a reality and give him his life back. He pulls out a gun and explains that he's coming home from a hard day at the office. Again, even in this moment, Bill is focused on the promise that working hard entitles him to an ideal home life. He even yells, "God bless the working stiff," as he waves the gun at strangers, causing them to flee.
What are you doing?
What do you think I'm doing? I'm coming home from a hard day at the office, right? God bless the working stiff!
Bill then hugs his daughter, and when Beth tells him he's sick, Bill retorts that he's not sick at all. It's the city that's sick.
You're sick.
Take a walk around this town, that's sick.
Just then, Prendergast interrupts casually, revealing his presence. Prendergast begins to talk to Bill about how everyone has their own idea of what paradise is. He explains that his idea of paradise was having kids.
You know what I thought paradise was?
What?
Making babies.
Prendergast points out that Bill's daughter is a gift, and tells the story of how he lost his own kid to sudden infant death syndrome at the late age of 2 years old.
Then the kid went to sleep one night, never woke up. Called it infant death syndrome. But she wasn't an infant, it was very strange because she was 2 years old, she was a big girl.
Prendergast then gives Bill's daughter a bucket of popcorn. This disarms Bill for a moment, and he lets his guard down, laying his gun to the side. But suddenly an LAPD squad car sounds its sirens on the pier, and when Bill is distracted, Prendergast and Bill share a nod, which prompts Beth to kick Bill's gun away. She makes her escape with her daughter, and Prendergast draws his weapon on Bill as he chases them. During the standoff, Prendergast holds yet another mirror to Bill. He points out that Bill was going to kill his wife and child, creating yet another point of no return, making it easy for him to justify doing the same thing to himself.
You were to kill your wife and child.
No.
Yeah, and then you knew it would be too late to turn back. It would be real easy to turn the gun around on yourself.
Bill denies this, if only once again to convince himself that it's not true. Prendergast then tells him to turn himself over to the police, aka the good guys. Bill ponders this and responds with a question of his own.
Now let's go meet some nice policemen. They're good guys. Come on, let's go.
I'm the bad guy?
Yeah.
Bill finally says what he's been feeling out loud.
I did everything they told me to. I helped to protect America.
You should be rewarded for that. Said they gave it to the plastic surgeon. You know, they lied to me.
And given how Bill and Prendergast started the day in somewhat parallel circumstances, Prendergast is unsurprisingly sympathetic to Bill at this moment. However, Prendergast shows us the difference between his perspective and Bill's with his next line.
Is that what this is about? You're angry because you got lied to? They lie to everybody. They lie to the fish. But that doesn't give you any special right to do what you did today. The only thing that makes you special is that little girl. Now let's go.
And finally, Bill gets his reminder of the small push it took for him to step over the line and throw his life away. Sure was hot today, wasn't it? On another day, Bill might have kept his cool in traffic and might never have embarked on this path. He might have been able to continue to live his life, his rage perpetually simmering just under his true boiling point. However, this day was particularly hot, and what Bill does next when faced with the consequences of his actions was always inevitable. Bill tells Prendergast that he has a gun and threatens to shoot. Prendergast tries to reason with Bill, with it being clear that Prendergast would have to shoot first in that case. Prendergast tells Bill that he should live for his daughter.
You have a choice. See, my little girl is dead. I don't have a choice. You have a choice.
But Bill says he has two choices.
I can kill you, or you can kill me, and my little girl can get the insurance.
Even when staring down the barrel of a gun, Bill can only think to value himself in terms of money. He sees dying as the only way to be considered economically viable and support his family. Bill ignores more of Prendergast's pleas and counts down to drawing his weapon. He finally reaches for it, and Prendergast is forced to shoot Bill and put him out of his misery. We see clearly after the shot is fired that Bill is holding his squirt gun. He never intended to kill Prendergast. He knew there was only one outcome. Usually a final showdown like this between the good guy and the bad guy, where good kills evil, is fitting and triumphant. It's black and white. But in this case, it's just really dark and depressing. It's an unfortunate shade of grey. The feeling of triumph is replaced by a feeling of unpreventable sadness. Not because Bill dies, but because of the circumstances that lead him to this point. But ultimately, Falling Down is a story about what can happen to a man, to any of us watching, who feels that we don't have any value anymore. In a society that's abandoned us, where nothing feels real, where everything feels so fake and hollow, it can push you to this point of madness. And when we abide and follow the psychoticness, it poisons our soul. You see, Bill Foster's biggest mistake in this entire movie was letting a society that values money above actual human life dictate his own self-worth. And although Bill is far from a hero in the story, he's a somewhat empathetic figure because we've all felt the way Bill does to some degree. It's easy to fall into the trap of thinking in terms of your own economic viability in a world that never ceases to shove it in your face. But unfortunately, the reality is that wealth in most countries is built on an increasingly fragile system. If you're a regular working person and your means of acquiring a respectable income crumbles due to the system, where nobody can afford to live, where $100,000 doesn't even seem to make it in most cases. When you see all this inflation, when prices keep going up, wages stagnating, everything becoming artificial, processed food, all the garbage you're watching on a day-to-day basis, means there's usually no safety net to catch you from falling down. And sometimes the difference between an accepted and functioning member of society and an outcast like Bill Foster is just one small push.